Good morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. Okay, today I thought I would go back and do a little history because history is always important and it's always interesting and it can shed light on the present. So what I thought I'd talk about is the history of life on Earth, because as we are in the sixth great mass extinction event, this one human cause, some people deny it. Number one, well, we're just insects crawling on the planet's face. And other people are like, so what? Things have died out before. Life always comes back. Well, life may always come back, but it wasn't here at the beginning. You know that, unless you're religious. But no, it was not here at the beginning. It took a long time for it to evolve. And then there was another mass extinction, which doesn't count in the six mass extinctions, because this one was mostly bacteria that died, so they don't count it. They just count the sexy ones like the dinosaurs. So I thought I'd talk about the Great Oxidation Event, because it shows that, number one, life was not always on Earth. Number two, if bacteria can change the atmosphere enough to wipe out almost all life on Earth, what can humans do? And number three, I don't know, it just seems to me like it's a shame to wipe out all of the current life on Earth, because there's a lot of amazing things on this Earth right now. But anyhow, I didn't know about this Great Oxidation Event. Well, I took biology and physiology and, you know, microbiology, and I don't remember learning about a lot of this stuff. I learned about anaerobic bacteria. I did know that Earth started out with no oxygen, and then now it's 21%. I did know that wiped out a lot of bacteria, but I thought only some of the bacteria survived and only as bacteria. But there's a theory that chlorophyll is actually an adaptation of anaerobic bacteria. And that is why it does the same thing the anaerobic bacteria of billions of years ago did. It turns carbon dioxide into oxygen. I think that's kind of interesting. Chlorophyll, huh? All right. And we know about tetanus, we know about clostridium, we know about botulism. These are three of the anaerobic bacteria that we still have on this planet. They hide where there's no oxygen. They can get humans. If you don't can your food right, or you step on a nail and you jam tetanus up into your tissues where there's no free oxygen, oh yeah, you can really mess yourself up. Gas gangrene. Yeah. Anyhow, that's just an aside. That's what I learned about because I took biology and microbiology geared toward nursing. So that's what they told us about. They didn't tell us about the Great Oxidation Event, but that was mostly geared toward. And I did learn about the Krebs cycle, but I don't remember ever learning about mitochondria, which is bizarre because that's what makes the whole thing possible. I might have been told it, and just the whole thing, ATP, and then this loses that, I don't know. Dan, and it turns out you could be a nurse without actually remembering how the Krebs cycle works. So there you go. All right, well, I'm getting this from Wikipedia, although Wikipedia is known to be highly edited by the CIA, in things that the CIA has no interest in contaminating the history of, it's going to be a good source of information. I assume the CIA has no interest in contaminating the history of the Great Oxidation Event. Maybe it does. Maybe it will someday. And all of a sudden you'll go to Wikipedia and the whole thing will be changed, because at some point they'll figure out, oh, wow, people don't want to let the ruling class destroy all life on Earth once they understand that life is not as durable as they have always been told. Then the CIA will come in and go, no, that didn't happen. Anyhow, the Great Oxidation Event, or Great Oxygenation Event, also called the Oxygen Catastrophe, which is, if you're looking at it from the point of view of the cyanobacteria, this is if you have sympathy for those low creatures. Oxygen Revolution, well, that's if you're like, yay, aerobic organisms evolve. Oxygen Crisis works either way, or Oxygen Holocaust. Another name sympathetic to the little cyanobacteria who made it all possible. Was a time interval during the early Earth's, I didn't ever take geology or anything like that, so I will stumble over the names here. If anyone actually knows how to pronounce them, my apologies to the rest of you. You're not going to know any better than me, so it's okay, right? Paleoproterozoic era, when the Earth's atmosphere and the shallow ocean first experienced a rise in the concentration of oxygen. This began approximately 2.4 billion years ago during the Siderian period and ended approximately 2.06 billion years ago during the Riocene. Geological, isotopic, and chemical evidence suggests that biologically produced molecular oxygen started to accumulate in Earth's atmosphere and changed it from a weakly reducing atmosphere, practically devoid of oxygen, into an oxidizing one containing abundant free oxygen, with oxygen levels being as high as 10% of their present atmospheric level by the end of the GOE. Okay, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and we didn't get oxygen on Earth until about 2.5 billion years ago. So we went 2 billion years without oxygen. And they'll say life on Earth began, 3.5 billion years ago, which makes it sound like it started right away. But guess what? That was the stuff that didn't use oxygen. The sudden injection of highly reactive free oxygen, toxic to the then mostly anaerobic biosphere, may have caused the extinctions of many organisms on Earth. Although the event is inferred to have constituted a mass extinction due in part to the great difficulty in surveying microscopic organisms' abundances, and in part due to the extreme age of fossil remains from that time, the great oxygenation event is typically not counted among conventional lists of great extinctions, which are implicitly limited to the Phanerozoic eon. In any case, isotope geochemistry data from sulfate minerals have been interpreted to indicate a decrease in the size of the biosphere of over 80% associated with changes in nutrient supplies at the end of the GOE, the Great Oxidation Event, that's GOE. The GOE is inferred to have been caused by cyanobacteria that evolved porphyrin-based photosynthesis, which produced dioxygen as a byproduct. The increasing oxygen level eventually depleted the reducing capacity of ferrous compounds, hydrogen sulfate, and atmospheric methane, and compounded by a global glaciation, devastated the microbial mats around the Earth's surface. See, photosynthesis, they invented that, and now that's what plants do. So I tend to believe the story that they evolved into chlorophyll in plants. I tend to believe that story. The subsequent adaptation of surviving archaea via symbiogenesis with aerobic proteobacteria may have led to the rise of eukaryotic organisms and the subsequent evolution of multicellular life forms. Okay, I know I learned about eukaryotic organisms, but I just don't remember how to pronounce it. So let me just talk a little bit about then mitochondria. Mitochondria is actually a little different organism that is present in all of our cells, except red blood cells. And it is not us. It is another organism. And yet, it is in us, it's in all animals, it's in all plants, and it's in fungi. So apparently, mitochondria are what made it possible for one-celled organisms to become multi-celled organisms. And they merged way, way back in the day, as we say. So probably, what would it be? 2.5 billion years ago, because that's when multicellular life started to form. Okay. So mitochondria are passed down through the female in the egg, because the egg's pretty big. Because mitochondria, they have to have room. They can't be in a little sperm floating around. So when you hear about tracing bloodlines or the mitochondrial Eve, and they trace human genetics back through the women, that's what they're tracing. They're tracing the mitochondria. So yeah, they can't do it through the men. The men just, they don't pass it on. Now, sexual reproduction means that each side produces half of the chromosomes. Like in humans, we have 46 chromosomes, and the male and the female each give 23. But again, the small gametes, the ones produced by men, they aren't the ones that pass down the mitochondria. It's the large gametes, the one produced by women. So it's just basic biology. In any case, of the 23 chromosomes contributed by the male and the female, the mitochondria does not split the way the human's cells split. So you're getting pure unadulterated mitochondria from your mama. Even though you get of your humanness, you get half of it from your daddy. So this is what they think might have happened. I think that's just interesting. Symbiogenesis is the leading evolutionary theory of the origin of eukaryotic from prokaryotic organisms. So I'm just going to read a little bit on mitochondria. That mitochondria, plastoids such as chloroplast and possibly other organelles of eukaryotic cells are descended from formerly free-living prokaryotics, more closely related to the bacteria than they are at archaea, taken one inside the other in endosymbiosis. Mitochondria appear to be phylogenetically related to Rickettsia's bacteria, while chloroplasts are thought to be related to cyanobacteria. Oh, that would be the humans and the plants, I guess. The idea that chloroplasts were originally independent organisms that merged into a symbiotic relationship with other one-celled organisms dates back to the 19th century. The endosymbiotic theory was articulated in 1905 and 1910 by the Russian botanist Konstantin Mirakayosky, and advanced and substantiated with the microbiological evidence by Lynn Margulis in 1967. Along the many lines of evidence supporting symbiogenesis are that new mitochondria and plastoids are formed only by splitting in two, and the cells cannot create new ones otherwise. That the transport proteins called porins are found in the outer membranes of mitochondria, chloroplast, and bacteria cell membranes, and that cardiolipin is found only in the inner mitochondrial membrane and bacteria cell membranes. So I think that's an interesting theory, but let's go back to the great oxidation event. The composition of the Earth's earliest atmosphere is not known with certainty. However, the bulk was likely nitrogen, well, still is. Now it's 80%, or almost 80%, 78%, and carbon dioxide, which are also the predominant nitro and carbon-bearing gases produced by volcanism today. These are relatively inert gases. Oxygen, O2, meanwhile, was present in the atmosphere in just 0.001% of its present atmospheric level. The sun shone at about 70% of its current brightness 4 billion years ago, but there is strong evidence that liquid water existed on Earth at the time. Don't know where that came from, but there you go. A warm Earth, in spite of a faint sun, is known as the faint young sun paradox. Either CO2 levels were much higher at the time, providing enough of a greenhouse effect to warm the Earth, or other greenhouse gases were present. The most likely such gas is methane, CH4, which is a powerful greenhouse gas and was produced by early forms of life known as methanogens. Scientists continue to research how the Earth was warmed before life arose. An atmosphere of nitrogen and carbon dioxide with trace amounts of water, carbon hydroxide, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen is described as a weakly reducing atmosphere. Such an atmosphere contains practically no oxygen. The modern atmosphere contains abundant oxygen, nearly 21%, making it an oxidizing atmosphere. The rise in oxygen is attributed to photosynthesis by cyanobacteria, which are thought to have evolved as early as 3.5 billion years ago. See, it took them a billion years then to destroy their environment. And it only took us, what, 200? Well, actually, it's really only been in the last 150 or so years that humans have really, really started to destroy the environment at industrial speed, so to speak. The current scientific understanding of when and how the Earth's atmosphere changed from a weakly reducing to a strongly oxidizing atmosphere largely began with the work of the American geophysicist Preston Cloud in the 1970s. Well, that's a cool name. I wonder why he wasn't famous. I never heard of him. Cloud observed that detrital sediments older than about 2 billion years contained grains of pyrite, uranate, and siderite, All minerals containing reduced forms of iron or uranium that are not found in younger sediments because they are rapidly oxidized in an oxidizing atmosphere. He further observed that continental red beds, which get their color from oxidized ferric mineral hematite, began to appear in the geological record at about this time. Banded iron formation largely disappears from the geological records at about 1.85 billion years ago, after peaking at about 2.5 billion. Banded iron formation can form only when abundant dissolved ferrous iron is transported into depositional basins, and an oxygenated ocean blocks such transport by oxidizing the iron to form insoluble ferric iron compounds. This should be a ferric oxide teaching moment, really. The end of the deposition of banded iron formation at 1.85 billion years ago is therefore interpreted as marking the oxygenation of the deep ocean. So again, that's only 1.85 billion years ago. We're starting to really move right along in the age of the Earth, which again is like 4.5 billion years. Look at that. That's already 3 billion years. Heinrich Holland further elaborated these ideas through the 1980s, placing the main time interview of oxygenation between 2.2 and 1.9 billion years ago. Constraining the atmospheric oxygenization has proven particularly challenging for geologists and geochemists. While there is a widespread consensus that initial oxygenation of the atmosphere happened sometime during the first half of the Paleoproterozoic, there is disagreement on the exact timing of this event. Scientific publications, well, you know what? This is just a little argument that Wikipedia gets into. We don't have to talk about this. Okay. Well, the GOE is generally thought to be a result of oxygenic photosynthesis by ancestral cyanobacteria, the presence of cyanobacteria in the Archean before the GOE is a highly controversial topic. Well, I don't know how it could change it if they weren't there. I mean, right? Structures that are claimed to be fossils of cyanotic bacteria exist in rock form 3.5 billion years ago. These include microfossils of supposedly cyanobacterial cells and microfossils called stromatolites, which are interpreted as colonies of microbes, including cyanobacteria, with characteristic layered structures. Modern stromatolites, which can only be seen in harsh environments such as Shark Bay in Western Australia, are associated with cyanobacteria, and thus fossil stromatolites had long been interpreted as the evidence for cyanobacteria. Additionally, Archean sedimentary rocks were once found to contain biomarkers, also known as chemical fossils, interpreted as fossilized membrane liquids from cyanobacteria and eukaryotes. For example, traces of 2-something methylpinenes and stearines that are thought to be derived from cyanobacteria and eukaryotes, respectively, were found in the Pilbara of Western Australia. Stearines are diagenetic products of sterols, which are biosynthesized utilizing molecular oxygen. Thus, stearines can additionally serve as an indicator of oxygen in the atmosphere. However, these biomarker samples have since shown to have been contaminated, and so the results are no longer accepted. Well, that's a problem with reading from Wikipedia. You get these little arguments in the meantime. So, the hypotheses. The ability to generate oxygen via photosynthesis likely first appeared in the ancestors of cyanobacteria. These organisms evolved at least 2.45 to 2.32 billion years ago, and probably as early as 2.7 or earlier. However, oxygen remained scarce in the atmosphere until around 2 billion years ago, and banded or iron formation continued to be deposited until about 1.8 billion years ago. Given the rapid multiplication rate of cyanobacteria under ideal conditions, an explanation is needed for the delay of at least 400 million years between the evolution of oxygen producing photosynthesis and the appearance of significant oxygen in the atmosphere. Well, that's just silly. We're talking about going from 0.001% to 21%. And they're like, what took so long? Why should it take 400 million years? Oh, please. Anyhow, Hypothesis to escape this gap must take into consideration the balance between oxygen sources and oxygen sinks. Oxygenic photosynthesis produces organic carbon that must be segregated from oxygen to allow oxygen accumulation in the surface environment. Otherwise, the oxygen back reacts with the organic carbon and does not accumulate. The burial of organic carbon sulfide and minerals containing ferrous iron is a primary factor in oxygen accumulation. When organic carbon is buried without being oxidized, the oxygen is left in the atmosphere. In total, the burial of organic carbon in pyrite today creates 1.5 tremoles of oxygen a year. This creates a net oxygen flux from the global oxygen sources. Preston Cloud originally proposed that the first cyanobacteria had evolved the capacity to carry out oxygen-producing photosynthesis, but it had not yet evolved enzymes for living in an oxygenated environment. These cyanobacteria would have been protected from their own poisonous oxygen waste through its rapid removal via the high levels of reduced ferrous iron in the early ocean. He suggested that the oxygen released by photosynthesis oxidized the iron to ferric iron, which precipitated out of the seawater to form banded iron formation. He interpreted the great peak and deposition of banded iron formation at the end of the Archean as the signature for the evolution of mechanisms for living with oxygen. This ended self-poisoning and produced a population explosion in the cyanobacteria that rapidly oxygenated the ocean and ended banded iron formation deposition. Most modern interpretations describe the GOE as a long protracted process that took place over hundreds of millions of years rather than a single abrupt event. Well, that makes more sense to me. With the quality of atmospheric oxygen fluctuating in relation to the capacity of oxygen sinks and the productivity of oxygenated photosynthesizers over the course of the GOE. More recently, families of bacteria have been discovered that closely resemble cyanobacteria, but show no indication of having ever possessed photosynthetic capability. These may be descended from the earliest ancestors of cyanobacteria, which only later acquired photosynthetic ability by lateral gene transfer. Another possibility is that early cyanobacteria were starved for vital nutrients and thus checked their growth. However, a lack of the scarcest nutrients, iron, nitrogen, and phosphorus, which have slowed, could have slowed, but not prevented a cyanobacteria population explosion and rapid oxygenation. One hypothesis suggests that the oxygen increase had to await tectonically driven changes in the Earth, including the appearance of self-seas, where reduced organic carbon could reach the sediments and be buried. The burial of reduced carbon as graphite or diamond around subduction zones released molecular oxygen into the atmosphere. The appearance of oxidized magmas enriched in sulfur formed around subduction zones confirms changes in tectonic regime played an important role in the oxygenation of Earth's atmosphere. The newly produced oxygen was first consumed in various chemical reactions in the oceans, primarily with iron. Evidences found in older rocks that contain massive banded iron formations apparently lay down as this iron and oxygen first combined. Most present-day iron ores lie in these deposits. It was assumed oxygen release from cyanobacteria resulted in the chemical reactions that created rust, but it appears the iron formations were caused by anorganic phototrophic iron oxidizing bacteria, which does not require oxygen. Evidence suggests oxygen levels spiked each time smaller land masses collided to form a supercontinent. Tectonic pressure thrust up mountain change, which eroded, releasing nutrients into the ocean that fed photosynthetic bacteria. See, you gotta have those volcanoes, right? And earthquakes. Eventually, oxygen started to accumulate in the atmosphere with two major consequences. Oxygen likely oxidized atmospheric methane, a strong greenhouse gas, to carbon dioxide, a weaker one, and water. This weakened the greenhouse effect of the Earth's atmosphere, causing planetary cooling, which has been proposed to have triggered a series of ice ages known as the Huronian glaciation, bracketing an age range of 2.45 to 2.22 billion years ago. The increased oxygen concentrations provided a new opportunity for biological diversification, as well as tremendous changes in the nature of chemical interactions between rocks, sand, clay, and other geological substrates, and the Earth's air, oceans, and other surface waters. Despite the natural recycling of organic matter, life had remained energetically limited until the widespread availability of oxygen. The availability of oxygen greatly increased the free energy available to living organisms with global environmental impacts. For example, mitochondria evolved after the GOE, giving organisms the energy to exploit new, more complex morphologies interacting in increasingly complex ecosystems, although these did not appear until the late Proterozoic and Cambrian. Okay, so what they're saying there is, because this is more of a, what they're saying there is the mitochondria, like I said, the mitochondria's ability to take oxygen and sugar and turn it into, or glucose, and turn it into energy is what made all of the life on Earth, which at that point was single cell, be able to evolve into multi-celled organisms. And that is a big step forward in life on Earth as we know it. So that's pretty amazing. It has been proposed that a local rise in oxygen level due to cyanobacteria photosynthesis in ancient microenvironments was highly toxic to the surrounding biota, and thus selective pressure drove the evolutionary transformation of an archaeal lineage into the first eukaryotes. Again, that took mitochondria, though. Among hallmark eukaryote features, the timing of mitochondrial acquisition has received particular attention. There's unanimous agreement on three aspects of mitochondrial origins. First, it is beyond doubt that all known present-day eukaryotes descend from an ancestor that already possessed a mitochondrion. Second, there's full agreement that one of the partners in this association was a bacteria cell. Finally, there's no doubt that the host cell is more closely related to modern archaea than it is to any lineage of bacteria, although its precise nature is a matter of ongoing debate. Endosymbiosis is a process that has a profound impact on all extant eukaryotes and is one of the clearest examples of an evolutionary transition. Mitochondrial acquisition is so fundamental that it is ubiquitously reflected in modern eukaryote cell biology. Modern mitochondria, mycosomes, and hydrogenosomes all trace back to this ancestral endosymbiont. Given the huge energetic gains associated with oxidative phosphorylation, it seems reasonable to expect that acquisition of mitochondria was so advantageous that mitochondrion-bearing lineages ultimately swept to fixation, explaining why no living fossils of intermediate stages persist. This makes it particularly difficult to establish when the mitochondrion was acquired along the path leading to LECA. Well, there you go. They don't know exactly how it happened, when it happened. They don't exactly when, but they're pretty within a billion years. Well, I mean, within a few hundred million years or so. And how it happened? Well, just two totally separate creatures got together and all of a sudden it was magic. All right. Well, anyhow, I thought this is interesting. And I'm very interested in this and I thought it would be interesting for people. And remember, if we carry on the way we are, we're going to end up like cyanobacteria, either extinct or living in a tree leaf. So we better change our ways. All right, that's the end of Occupy the Airwaves.